A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Imagine you're walking down King George Street. It's 3 in the afternoon on a Tuesday. The street is torn open, barriers everywhere, the usual Jerusalem chaos diverted into side alleys. And on this massive construction site, you can count the workers on one hand. By 4 o'clock, it's a ghost town. And you think to yourself, this is a main thoroughfare. A multi-billion shekel infrastructure project, and it feels like they're building a garden shed at a retirement home. So Daniel sent us this one, and he's asking point blank, is this pace normal, or is something broken? And if other cities run construction sites 24/7, why can't Jerusalem?
The short answer is that the pace is both normal and maddening, and the explanation has almost nothing to do with the workers you see standing around. The visible surface crew is maybe the worst possible proxy for whether a project like this is on schedule. But to understand why, we have to look at three things: the contract structure that pays for the work, the hidden army of people you never see, and the municipal rules that dictate when a hammer can even swing.
Let's step back and ask, what is actually determining the pace of this project? It's not what you think.
And the first thing to understand is that the JNet Light Rail expansion, which is what's tearing up King George Street right now, is budgeted at roughly 11 billion shekels. That's about 3 billion US dollars. It's the largest infrastructure project in Jerusalem's modern history, and it's structured as multiple design, bid, build packages. This is the key to everything.
Design, bid, build. Unpack that for me. Because it sounds like exactly the kind of phrase that hides a world of incentives.
Design. Bid build, or DBB, is the traditional procurement model for public works in Israel. Here's how it works. The government, or the municipality, hires one firm to design the project, then puts that completed design out to tender. Contractors bid on it, and the lowest qualified bidder wins. So you have a fixed design, a fixed price, and a contractor who is legally obligated to deliver exactly what's in the design documents, nothing more, nothing less.
The contractor has zero incentive to finish early.
Worse than zero. In a pure DBB contract, if the contractor finds a way to finish 6 months ahead of schedule, they don't get a bonus. They just stop getting paid 6 months earlier. Meanwhile, any change to the design, any unexpected condition underground, any utility that wasn't where the map said it would be, that triggers a change order. And change orders are negotiated separately, typically on a time and materials basis. So, the contractor's actual profit margin lives in the change orders.
Which creates a hurry-up-and-wait rhythm. Rush to the point where you hit something unexpected, then slow down to negotiate.
And Jerusalem is a city where you hit something unexpected roughly every 40 meters. So the visible pace you see on King George Street is a direct reflection of the procurement model. The contractor isn't lazy. They're responding rationally to the incentive structure they were given. If you want a contractor to finish early, you need a different contract model. Something like progressive design build, where the contractor is brought in during the design phase and shares in the cost savings from early completion. But that model is rare in Israeli public infrastructure, partly because it requires a level of trust and flexibility that public tendering laws make difficult.
The system is designed to produce exactly the pace we're seeing. That's one layer. But even within that system, the number of workers on site seems absurdly low. 2 or 3 people on a street that's been closed for months.
This is where the hidden army comes in. The 2 workers you see on the surface are the tip of an iceberg. Below ground, sometimes literally, there are surveyors, geotechnical engineers, utility relocation crews, archaeological supervision teams, and concrete specialists managing curing schedules. A crew of 50 might be working in a tunnel section 200 meters away that you can't see from the street. And a lot of the work that determines the schedule isn't construction at all, it's coordination meetings. A single 12-inch water main relocation under King George Street can involve 5 different utility companies, each with their own contractors, their own schedules, and their own liability concerns.
Those meetings don't happen on the street with hard hats and shovels. They happen in offices, and they take months.
The Tel Aviv Light Rail Red Line, which finally opened in August of 2023, took over 12 years from initial planning to revenue service. And Tel Aviv has far fewer archaeological constraints than Jerusalem. During those 12 years, there were long stretches where the surface looked almost idle, but the critical path wasn't on the surface. The real bottleneck was tunneling under the Ayalon Highway, which required 18 months of advanced geotechnical work before a single tunnel boring machine moved. Nobody walking past the site saw any of that.
The visible emptiness is misleading, but it's also not the whole story. There's another dimension to this, which is when the work actually happens, or doesn't happen. The Friday shutdown, the 4 p.m. ghost town. Is that just Israeli work culture, or is there something structural there too?
It's almost entirely structural. In Israel, most collective bargaining agreements for construction workers mandate a 5-day work week, Sunday through Thursday. Friday is technically a short day for office workers, but for heavy construction, it's often a full day off. And it's not just about the workers showing up. You also can't get material deliveries on Friday because the suppliers are closed. Concrete batching plants shut down. Steel suppliers are unavailable, so even if you wanted to work, you couldn't.
That's the union side. But there's also the municipal side.
Right, and this is where Jerusalem specifically differs from a lot of other cities. Section 5 of the Jerusalem Municipal Noise Prevention Bylaw, enacted in 2011, prohibits construction in residential zones between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. It also prohibits construction on Fridays from 1 p.m. until Saturday night. The fines for violations can reach 50,000 shekels per incident.
50,000 shekels is not a slap on the wrist.
It's not. And the city council has explicitly chosen to enforce these bylaws strictly, even for the JNet project. They've prioritized resident quality of life over construction speed. That's a political choice, and it's one that the listener walking down King George Street at 4:30 p.m. is experiencing firsthand.
When Daniel asks whether a 24/7 construction schedule is an unrealistic standard for municipalities to meet, the answer is that it's not unrealistic in a vacuum. It's unrealistic in Jerusalem specifically, because Jerusalem has made a series of explicit decisions that make it impossible.
Those decisions aren't arbitrary. Let's look at what a 24/7 project actually requires. You need noise exemptions from the municipality, which means you need political cover for council members who are going to get angry calls from constituents at 3 a.m. You need a much higher budget for artificial lighting, for security, for night shift wage premiums. You need labor agreements that allow for night work, which in Israel would require renegotiating sector-wide collective bargaining agreements. And you need a supply chain that can deliver materials around the clock, which means concrete plants, steel yards, and logistics hubs that operate 24 hours.
The Crossrail project in London, the Elizabeth Line, had 24-hour working zones, but only in specific tunnel segments deep underground. The surface station works were strictly 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. because of noise covenants with the neighborhoods above. So even the projects people point to as examples of round-the-clock pace are more constrained than they appear.
Crossrail had a budget that makes JNet look modest. The final cost was around £19 billion. They could afford the noise mitigation, the resident compensation schemes, the dedicated logistics. Jerusalem's budget simply doesn't include that kind of mitigation fund. The city made a trade-off, accept a longer construction period in exchange for lower immediate disruption to daily life.
Which brings us to the two hidden taxes that no amount of money can speed up. Archaeology and utilities.
Jerusalem is arguably the most archaeologically sensitive city in the world. Every shovel of dirt requires supervision from the Israel Antiquities Authority. In 2024 alone, the IAA documented over 1,200 archaeological features during light rail excavations. That's not an exaggeration, that's the official number. 1,200 separate finds that required documentation, assessment, and in many cases, full excavation before construction could continue.
If they find something significant, a Byzantine cistern, an Ottoman wall fragment, a Second Temple period mikveh, work stops, not for hours, for days or weeks.
This is non-negotiable. It's baked into the project schedule at a high level, but the specific delays are impossible to predict. You don't know what's underground until you dig. And in Jerusalem, what's underground is basically a layer cake of 3,000 years of continuous human habitation. Every meter you go down, you're moving through multiple civilizations.
The contractor is digging, finds something, and then has to call in the IAA. The IAA sends an archaeologist. The archaeologist documents the find. If it's significant, a full salvage excavation begins. The contractor's crew can't work in that zone during the excavation. The schedule slips.
Here's the thing about DBB contracts. An archaeological find is a classic change order trigger. It's an unforeseen site condition. So the contractor stops work, files a change order, negotiates the additional cost and time with the municipality, and only then resumes. The delay compounds.
The pace isn't just slow because of archaeology. It's slow because the contract model turns every archaeological find into a negotiation.
Now add utilities. Under King George Street, there are water mains from the British Mandate era. There are fiber optic cables, high voltage electricity lines, gas pipes, and sewage systems. Many of these were installed decades ago and were never properly mapped. The as-built drawings, if they exist at all, are often inaccurate. So you dig, and you find a water main that wasn't supposed to be there. Or you find a fiber bundle that serves half the neighborhood and can't be moved without a 6-month coordination process.
6 months for one pipe?
Relocating a single 12-inch water main can take 3 to 4 months of coordination with 5 different utility companies. Each company has its own contractor, its own schedule, its own budget cycle. You can't just show up and move their infrastructure. You have to negotiate access windows, liability terms, and cost-sharing agreements. And during all of that negotiation, the construction site looks empty.
There's a number that puts this in perspective. According to a 2024 internal report from the Jerusalem Municipality, utility relocation accounted for 62% of project delays on the Green Line extension. Only 18% was actual construction delays.
62%. That's the hidden work. The coordination meetings, the permit applications, the utility mapping, the archaeological supervision. None of it involves a worker with a shovel on King George Street, but it's where the project's time actually goes.
When you walk past at 3 p.m. and see two guys leaning on a barrier, you're not seeing the project. You're seeing the visible 1% of a process that is mostly happening in offices, in tunnels, and in the ground itself.
That's before we even get to the concrete curing schedules. Concrete doesn't dry, it cures. It's a chemical reaction that takes time, and you can't rush it. If you pour a structural slab, it might need 7 days of curing before it can bear load. During those 7 days, the site looks idle, but it's not. It's doing chemistry.
Let's talk about the comparison Daniel raised. He's seen sites in other places, presumably East Asia or the US, that operate on a 24/7 or 24/5 timeline with artificial illumination and crews working through the night. Is that a realistic standard for a city like Jerusalem?
It's a standard that requires specific legal, financial, and social conditions that Jerusalem doesn't have and has explicitly chosen not to create. Let's take Singapore as an example. The Thomson East Coast Line managed 24/7 tunneling, but they built dedicated noise barrier tunnels and paid compensation to residents in affected zones. Singapore also has a very different governance model. The Land Transport Authority has sweeping powers to override local objections. There's no equivalent of the Jerusalem Municipal Noise Prevention Bylaw, because the national government can simply preempt municipal concerns.
Singapore doesn't have 3,000-year-old cisterns under every street.
But even setting aside archaeology, the 24/7 model requires weak or flexible noise ordinances, strong contractor liability protections, high labor supply for night shifts, and a political culture that prioritizes infrastructure speed over resident comfort. Jerusalem has strong noise ordinances, a limited night labor pool, and a political culture that is extremely responsive to resident complaints. City council members in Jerusalem get phone calls. They act on them.
The 50,000 shekel fine is not theoretical. It's an enforcement mechanism with political backing.
And here's a comparison that might help. In many U.S. cities, major highway projects do run 24/7, but they're typically in commercial or industrial zones, not in dense residential neighborhoods. When a project does run through a residential area, you see exactly the same constraints. The big dig in Boston had night work, but it also had massive community opposition, lawsuits over noise, and eventually, strict limits on construction hours in certain segments. The idea that 24/7 is the global norm is just not accurate. It's the exception, and it's usually confined to specific tunnel segments or industrial zones.
The listener's frustration is real. The pace feels glacial. But the frustration is misdirected at the workers on site, rather than at the procurement system, the archaeological reality, and the political choices that govern construction hours.
Here's the deeper point. The slow pace isn't a bug. It's a feature of Jerusalem's governance model. The city has decided, through its bylaws, its contract structures, and its enforcement priorities, that resident welfare during construction matters more than shaving 2 years off the project timeline. You can disagree with that choice, but it's a choice, not an accident.
There's a political philosophy embedded in a construction schedule. The empty site at 4 p.m. is a value judgment.
And the value judgment is, people who live near the construction site deserve to sleep. Their children deserve quiet evenings. Their Shabbat peace is worth protecting. The trade-off is that the construction takes longer and the street stays torn up for more months.
Whether that trade-off is worth it depends on whether you live next to the site or you're trying to drive down King George Street.
And that tension is not unique to Jerusalem. Every dense historic city grappling with major infrastructure faces it. London, Rome, Paris, Istanbul. They all have archaeological constraints, noise ordinances, and political systems that slow things down. Jerusalem just has all three in extreme form.
If the visible pace is misleading, how should you actually evaluate whether this project is on track?
The first thing is to stop using visible workers as a metric. It's a terrible proxy. Instead, look at milestone achievement. The JNet website publishes monthly progress reports. They're not always easy to find, but they're public. Look for things like tunnel segment completed, station excavation finished, track bed installed. Those are the real indicators. A site with zero visible workers can be right on schedule if the critical path work is happening elsewhere.
The critical path work for a project like this is disproportionately in the early phases. Utility relocation, archaeological clearance, geotechnical preparation. Those are the phases that look the most idle from the street.
The Tel Aviv Red Line spent years in that phase. The actual track laying and station fitting out happened relatively quickly at the end. But by then, the public had already formed the impression that the project was perpetually delayed. The psychology of infrastructure projects is that the invisible work dominates the early timeline, and the visible work comes late. But humans judge progress by what they can see.
You spend 5 years thinking nothing is happening, and then in year 6, suddenly, there's a train running.
The train didn't appear by magic. It appeared because of 5 years of invisible work, but nobody walking past the site in year 3 knew that.
There's a broader lesson here about how we evaluate public projects. We tend to assume that if a site looks busy, progress is happening. If it looks empty, it's stalled. But in complex urban infrastructure, the opposite can be true. A busy site might mean the contractor is frantically redoing work that was botched. An empty site might mean the critical path task is a coordination meeting happening 3 floors underground in a municipal office building.
The coordination meeting is probably the most important work of all. I've seen estimates that on a project like this, 30 to 40% of the total labor hours are spent on coordination, not construction. That's not waste. That's the necessary overhead of building something through a living city without destroying the city in the process.
Like performing surgery on a patient who is awake and going about their daily life.
That's exactly the metaphor. You're replacing major arteries while the patient is still walking around. You can't just knock them out and take your time. You have to work around the existing systems, keep the blood flowing, and not sever anything critical.
What can the listener actually do with this information? If you're walking down King George Street, frustrated, what should you look for?
First, check the project dashboard. The JNet monthly reports will tell you what milestone was just achieved and what's coming next. If the report says a utility relocation was completed last week, the empty site you're seeing might be the calm before the next phase of active construction. Second, look for the invisible work. Are there surveyors' markings on the pavement? Is there a utility company truck parked on a side street? Those are signs that coordination is happening. Third, adjust your expectations. The full JNet network is scheduled for 2030. That's the official timeline. Given the structural forces we've discussed, utility relocations, archaeology, contract negotiations, I would be surprised if it hits that date. But the delays will be from those structural forces, not from the two workers you see at 3 p.m.
The 2030 date, is that realistic?
If I'm being honest, probably not. The Tel Aviv Red Line took 12 years with fewer archaeological constraints. The J-Net is more complex, through denser and more historic terrain, with more utility conflicts. I would expect the full network to be closer to 2032 or 2033, but that's me speculating. The official schedule says 2030.
The listener's observation that the pace feels relaxed is accurate as a sensory experience. The site does look understaffed and it does shut down early. But the explanation isn't laziness or incompetence. It's the contract structure, the hidden work, the archaeological supervision, the utility coordination, and the municipal noise bylaws. Five structural forces, all of them invisible from the street, all of them conspiring to produce exactly the base we see.
Here's the thing that might reframe this entirely. The fact that the site shuts down at 4 p.m. and takes Fridays off, that's not a failure of project management. That's the project operating exactly as designed. The municipality designed a procurement and regulatory environment that produces this pace. If they wanted a faster pace, they would need to change the contract model, renegotiate the labor agreements, amend the noise bylaws, and allocate budget for resident compensation and night work premiums. They haven't done any of that.
Which tells you that the pace is intentional. Not optimal necessarily, but intentional.
Intentional and, in a democratic city with strong resident protections, probably inevitable. The alternative is a governance model where the state can override local objections and impose 24/7 construction on neighborhoods. That model exists. Singapore uses it. China uses it extensively. But it's not Jerusalem's model, and it's probably not what Jerusalem's residents would choose if given the option.
There's a question embedded in Daniel's prompt that we haven't directly addressed. He asks, am I wrong about this? And the answer is, you're right about what you're seeing, but wrong about what it means. The site is quiet. The pace is slow. But the causes are systemic, not individual. The workers aren't the bottleneck. The system is.
That's actually a more useful insight than just saying the project is mismanaged. Because if you understand the system, you can advocate for changing it. If you think Jerusalem should prioritize construction speed over resident quiet, you can push for amendments to the noise bylaws. If you think the DBB contract model creates perverse incentives, you can push for progressive design build on future packages. The frustration becomes productive when you aim it at the right target.
Here's what I'm taking away from this. When you walk past a construction site that looks empty, you're not seeing a failure of work ethic. You're seeing the visible surface of a system whose real work is coordination, archaeology, utility relocation, and concrete chemistry. The number of visible workers is a terrible proxy for progress. The Friday shutdown is a contractual and regulatory reality, not a cultural preference. And the 24/7 construction model that looks like the global standard is actually a specific institutional choice that requires conditions Jerusalem has explicitly rejected.
The broader pattern here, which I think is worth sitting with, is that as cities worldwide grapple with aging infrastructure and climate adaptation, the tension between resident welfare and construction speed is only going to intensify. Jerusalem is a case study in how a democratic, historically dense city resolves this tension. The resolution is messy, slow, and frustrating to walk past, but it's a resolution, not an abdication.
Every city that tries to build major infrastructure through its own living core is going to face some version of this. The archaeology might be different. The noise bylaws might be looser. But the fundamental tension between getting it done fast and not making life unlivable for the people who already live there, that's universal.
The cities that appear to resolve it quickly, the Singapores and the Shanghais, they're not resolving the tension, they're suppressing one side of it. They're choosing speed over resident comfort, and they have the governance tools to make that choice stick. Jerusalem doesn't have those tools and arguably doesn't want them.
The next time you're walking down King George Street and you see an empty construction site at 4:15 p.m., you can be annoyed. That's fair. But you can also know that the emptiness is a sign that the city is building infrastructure, the Jerusalem way, slowly, carefully, with archaeology and utilities and noise complaints all given their due. Whether that's the right way is a political question. Whether it's the intentional way is not.
If you want to know whether it's actually working, don't count the workers. Check the milestones.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, a linguist working in Patagonia documented a Tehuelche Welch speaker who produced click consonants, a phonetic feature otherwise known almost exclusively from Khoisan languages of southern Africa. The speaker was elderly, and the clicks were vestigial, appearing in only a handful of words. No other linguist ever recorded the phenomenon in Tehuelche, making it a single-source linguistic ghost.
A single-source linguistic ghost in Patagonia of all places. The JNEP Project. 2030 is the official target. Based on everything we've discussed, I'd put the over-under closer to 2032. But the thing to watch isn't the date. It's whether the milestones keep ticking forward month by month, even when the street looks empty. Because in a city like Jerusalem, the real work is almost always the work you can't see.
If the listener takes one thing from this, I hope it's a new mental model for reading a construction site. Visible activity is a surface indicator. The real story is in the contracts, the archaeology reports, the utility coordination meetings, and the curing concrete. Infrastructure is slow because the city is alive, and building through a living city is one of the hardest engineering challenges there is.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, we're at My Weird Prompts.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.